What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello from Marlo, Bulawanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It is Thursday, October 16. I'm Kyle Evans. I'll be with you for the next couple of weeks while Agi Tupou takes a well-earned break. Coming up today, Samoa's former PM sues the man who beat her at the last election. Also, we'll take a broad look at Micronesia's shipwrecks and the threat they pose 80 years on from World War II.
Their estimate is from 3.5 to 6 million gallons of oil still in our waters.
And PNG launches round two of its nationwide polio immunization campaign.
Second round will now cover the entire part of the country, that including the Nguyen Islands region and some parts of the southern region.
All that and more coming up today. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Let's get started. But first, today marks the 50-year anniversary of the Balabo Five murders. Five Australian journalists working in East Timor who were killed by Indonesian forces as they reported on an invasion in the border town of Balabo. Today, Balabo is a very different place, with the anniversary being used to celebrate press freedom. But the events remain raw for family members of the Balabo Five, and 50 years on, they're still calling for justice. Pacific reporter Nick Sass is in Balabo and filed this report.
Walking around the streets of Balabo, seeing its landmarks and buildings, brings up a mix of heavy emotions for Evan Shackleton. It was in this town, 50 years ago, where his father took his last breath.
That's the flag house down there, the blue one. And when we came here in 2003, it jumped straight out. It was pretty much the only building left here after the militia had gone. I think they'd either smashed, burnt, or both. Everything else was here.
The flag house is where Evan's father, Channel 7 reporter Greg Shackleton, painted an Australian flag, nicknaming it the Australian Embassy. The journalists thought it would protect them. It didn't. And Evan's father, along with his four colleagues, were murdered by the invading Indonesian army. For Evan and the Balabo Five families, it was the start of 50 years of pain, with the Australian government long being accused of a cover-up, and the Indonesian army maintaining, to this day, they were killed in crossfire.
When people lie to you and they pretend that it's the truth, and you know it's not the truth, that made me angry.
From the moment they were killed, the government of the day and subsequent governments have just basically covered up what was happening.
That was fellow Balabo Five family member Greg Cunningham, the brother of murdered journalist Gary Cunningham. He says these days all the families want is an apology. He will not attend the anniversary in Balabo, preferring to have his own day of remembrance in Melbourne.
The next few days, especially the next week, is going to be a rather emotional time.
In a statement, the Australian government said it mourned the deaths and remained committed to transparency. The Indonesian government told the ABC it would prefer to move forward. Neither government offered an apology. Former Victorian Premier Steve Brax is now a fellow of the Balabo House Trust, a charity constructing schools in the region. He says that is one of the positives to come out of the tragic events.
To see that, you know, we've had all these developments that the community in Australia has got behind Balabo and made sure we had something good for the future.
And on the streets in Balabo, they are celebrating. The day is now used to celebrate press freedom. For Evan, this trip is his second time to Balabo after visiting in 2003. And today, although he's still angry, he's found perspective. And what's changed for you since over the past 20 years, seeing it now, Balabo?
I think I feel better about things now. I think I feel some sort of kinship with the people here.
Evan Shackleton, son of murdered journalist Greg Shackleton, ending that report from Nick Sass. To Samoa now, where former Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa is suing the man who beat her at the last election for defamation over claims she meddled in a murder investigation. The dispute stems from the death of American academic Caroline Gabbard, found dead last year in the home of Samoan writer Sia Figil, who's been charged with murder. Fiamme's defamation suit adds to the legal dramas surrounding her successor, Lawalia Ma'aliatoa Polatiba Foshi-Smit, who's also facing serious criminal charges. For more details, we're joined by our Samoa reporter, Adele Fruin, who's on the line from Apia. Malo, Adele, how are you today?
Oh, not too bad. Good morning.
First of all, who is involved in this civil claim and why is Fiamme alleging she was defamed?
Yes, now former Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa officially filed a 1.1 million defamation lawsuit against Samoa's current Prime Minister, Lauren Malietoa Polatiba Fosi. Now, she also, part of her lawsuit is also involves also Lauri's cousin or relative, and to be exact, her name is Lisa Marie Schmidt. This is for allegedly spreading false and malicious claims that she played a part or interfered in the high-profile murder investigation. Fiamme made the announcement that she was planning to file this lawsuit way before the election even happened. I believe, if I recall correctly, it was during the time before the election that she made this announcement. And now, finally, now after the election and everything has gone through, now she has officially filed it earlier this week on Monday.
So where and when were these allegations made, allegedly?
Yes, so allegedly the claim centres on remarks delivered by Prime Minister Lauren Malietoa during a fast party rally. Now, this was held on July 16, 2025 in Savai at the Fa'asaleleanga No. 4 district. Now, this was during the time when the fast party were going around the islands, actually both islands, everywhere, basically, campaigning. And part of their campaign, he also then allegedly made claims that Fiamme had given instructions to remove evidence related to the death of the woman, of our famous writer. So, yes, so these were the claims that now, has centered around the lawsuit, basically.
Well, I imagine this has gotten some tongues wagging around the country. Well, what are members of the public saying about the claim?
Even before former Prime Minister Fiamme was making conversations, she was hinting that she was going to file a lawsuit. There were mixed reactions from members of the public. During the first announcement, she was, not many members of the public believed she would actually go through with it. Some even went on social media and commenting on the fact that, the lawsuit in itself, they thought that, actually during that time, there were a lot, and I believe there were a lot of misinformation around this. It was already being spread online, that allegedly she was involved. So it really painted a bad picture for her during the campaign period. But members of the public criticized the fact that she was supposed to come forward and address the rumors. But during that time, she hardly addressed the rumors. She hardly addressed any of the criticism. But by the time she did address the criticism, it was too late, in the sense that it was members of the public were saying that it was just too late for her to answer these allegations against her. Now, for those that now, mind you, this announcement was done before the election, and then after the election, when later on she conceded defeat, and then some of members of the public had thought she had given up and would not file any lawsuit. However, she went on to say she will still file. Now, some were saying that she was not genuine about saying that she was giving over the, you know, the reins or the power to the Aulia Maliator over the fact that she says that, you know, she is giving them her trust, you know, and allowing them to take over. But now that she's filing this claim, it does not seem genuine to others, yes.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with our Samoan reporter Adele Fruin, and we're chatting about Samoa's former Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa, who is suing the very man that beat her at the last election. Now, Adele, do we know if there is a date for the hearing yet?
So far, there's no date or hearing date has been set yet. Yes, the claim was filed earlier this week. It's a civil claim, but yes, not yet. It hasn't been announced yet that there's a hearing date, so no.
And can you give us an update on the ongoing case against the PM? I remember when Parliament sat for the first time last week and he was obviously absent, still getting some care in New Zealand.
Yes, that's correct. So last week in court, it was supposed to be the final day for submissions, all for both prosecution. But however, during the court case, prosecution was not ready to file their final submission, hence why the judge gave them and also postponed the dates to the 24th and the 25th of November, that will give them enough time to file their final submissions, and have given them until the 14th, actually, to first file their final submissions before, you know, coming to before court, basically. So yes, it's still ongoing, and it's interesting enough to note that Lauli Alimaliator has joint charges with the same relative that the Prime Minister is suing in this lawsuit. So, you know, right now there's an ongoing case where Lauli is involved, plus has a relative, Lisa. So it's important to note that they two are the ones that are part of this lawsuit that she's currently filing. So, yes.
Yes, it's interesting stuff, to say the least. And in case you know, how is his health by all accounts? Is he fit and healthy and back in Parliament at the moment?
No, he's not. He's expected to arrive back on island on the 19th of October. So he's still not in the country, but he did do a live update earlier this week saying that he's recovering well. He had surgery, but he's trying his best to get back, you know, in the country and, you know, carry out his duties as Prime Minister. But so far, he's still not here yet.
Our thoughts do go out to him. Adele, that's all we've got time for this morning, but thanks so much for joining us, as always, on Pacific Beat.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day.
Likewise. That was the ABC's Samoan reporter, Adele Fruin.
Pacific Beat.
To Micronesia now, where beneath the waves of Chuuk Lagoon is an underwater museum like no other. A ghost fleet of ships and aircraft, once part of a formidable Japanese naval base, now dot the floor of the state of Chuuk's shallow waters. They lie amid an abundance of coral and sea life, creating a spectacular realm for tourists willing to travel the vast distance to see it. However, Chuuk's major tourism attraction is also a threat to its very survival. Let's take a listen. Swimming amid the shipwrecks of Micronesia's Chuuk Lagoon is like diving into a time machine for Ranger Walter.
Like if you go inside the kitchen, you see all the things that we don't even have in Chuuk, like at that time. It just makes me like addicted to it, like it's another world.
Ranger is the historic preservation officer in the state of Chuuk. He swims among Chuuk's 64 shipwrecks often, ensuring the relics and artifacts within remain undisturbed.
You like make sure that there is the place in the kitchen are still there. There's toilets, there is gun, there is handgun, And there is like a lot of bones too, like human remains, yeah.
More than 4,000 Japanese soldiers perished when Chuuk was bombarded by US forces at the tail end of World War II. 63 vessels were sunk in what battlefield historian Mac McLaughlin says was revenge for Pearl Harbor.
As the war went on, they were pushed back quicker and quicker. And yeah, Chuuk is, you know, a perfect example of that, of a base that had been set up as an offensive, base to launch attacks on other areas of the Pacific, soon became a bit of an albatross for them that they were stuck in.
Today, Chuuk Lagoon is home to one of the highest concentrations of World War II shipwrecks in the world. The wrecks, along with the abundance of coral and sea life, make them a bucket list destination for scuba divers, according to Peter Atten, Chuuk's Division Chief of Commerce and Industry.
It is the main driver of our tourism over here. 75 to 80% of our tourism come here because of the shipwrecks.
But in the early 2000s, this ghost fleet of wrecks quite literally came back to haunt them.
Way back in early 2000, that's when we first received reports from our fishermen of leaking oil.
Soon after, oil from the wrecks washed up on shore after a strong storm, sparking an international call for aid from the country's then leader, Manny Mori, who labelled the wrecks a ticking time bomb. Help came via Japan's Mine Action Service, which, according to a recent report, has extracted 60,000 litres of oil from the lagoon since beginning operations in 2017. But it only scratches the surface of the overall threat, with recent estimates suggesting up to 22 million litres could still be contained within the vessels.
What's happening right now with global warming and all that, and what's happening to our sea, the rate of deterioration of our shipwrecks has sped up and has started to erode much quicker than we anticipated.
In February, Australia funded an extensive study of the wrecks at the request of Micronesia's government. The study determined 15 of the wrecks would need to be cleaned within 5 to 10 years to prevent a potential large-scale spill. But in September, just a few months after the study was submitted, disaster struck when one of the vessels assessed in the study sprung a leak, which left a layer of oil 10 centimetres thick on the shoreline of a nearby village.
Currently, we are telling the locals to stay away from the water. The oil has reached inland. The four affected villages don't have deep well. They're using rainwater. So there is no contamination of their local water. But they have been reported cases of dizziness and all like that due to the fumes.
A state of emergency was declared, with Micronesia's president, Wesley Siminna, raising the matter during his address at the UN General Assembly, saying the scale of the problem far exceeds Micronesia's capacity to address the issue alone. However, getting help is not so simple. According to maritime archaeologist Matt Carter, removing oil from shipwrecks and disposing it safely takes place often in other areas of the world, but at a steep price. He said cleaning up a single wreck in Chuuk could cost upwards of $10 million.
The challenge with working in the Pacific, so Chuuk, Solomons, and Marshall Islands, is just the sheer distances involved for getting kind of the vessels you'd need, the people, all the equipment there. So the cost is significantly higher than the rest of the world, and the countries in this part of the world are, you know, significantly poorer, generally speaking.
There's also no obligation for countries responsible for putting the wrecks there in the first place to assist, according to Donald Rothwell, a maritime expert and professor of international law at the Australian National University.
The scenario that you're discussing falls within effectively a grey area, because at the time, the modern territories within which these wrecks are located did not exist as independent states. Micronesia has some potential leverage, given its status with the United States under the Compact of Free Association. But otherwise, there is something of a political movement to try to reach a global settlement on this question, but that's a process that will take some time.
In the meantime, Chuuk have applied to have the wrecks placed on the UNESCO World Heritage List to build their profile and shed further light on the issue. Outside of that, Peter Atten says there's not much more they can do on their own.
This is just the beginning. So this will be the first one that is leaking out. They did a study on 20 of the shipwrecks. And their estimate is from 3.5 to 6 million gallons of oil spill in our waters. So that would be a very big devastation if one or two or all of them start leaking out at the same time.
That was Chuuk Division Chief of Commerce and Industry, Peter Atten, ending that report from myself there. It is that time of the morning where we take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific region. And to do that, I am joined once again by producer Jordan Fennell. Jordan, how is life treating you today?
Once again, it's going well. I have had my coffee, so I'm awake and ready to bring the news.
That is excellent. Well, let's start in Papua New Guinea because their defence force could soon go hungry because of an unpaid catering bill. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so this story is coming from The Australian, who are reporting that the current catering contractor for PNG's Defence Force, IPI Catering, is warning that it will stop its services if the Defence doesn't pay a $6.2 million bill that dates back to March. IPI Catering caters and provides food for PNG's Defence Force, which is 3,500 strong. Alongside this in the report, The Australian is saying that late payments from PNG's government have also caused a shutdown of electricity, gas, and water services at PNG's defence bases. Now, of course, this all comes after PNG and Australia recently signed the Puk Puk Treaty, a defence pact that commits Australia and PNG to fight with each other in the event of an armed attack against either one. And The Australian is reporting that PNG's Defence Minister, Billy Joseph, and Australia's Defence Minister, Richard Marles, have declined to answer questions about this unpaid catering bill.
Yeah, that's a very concerning story, yes, especially given the timing of that Puk Puk Treaty, because the last thing you would want before that treaty gets underway is, yeah, the potential cultural and lifestyle differences that all of a sudden another defence force might offer that one can't as this gets up and running. So,
and hungry soldiers, I guess. We don't want that.
Exactly. Yes, yes. Not at all. Number two, to Tuvalu, where phase two of the coastal adaptation project has been completed. What's happened there?
Yeah, so just a reminder for everyone, the Coastal Adaptation Project is a project funded by Australia, New Zealand and the US, which aims at reducing Tuvalu's vulnerability to sea level rise by building coastal protections. This actually started way back in 2017 and now phase two is complete. What phase two looks like with this project is that they've actually reclaimed an elevated 8 hectares of land in Funafuti, the nation's capital. Now, according to the United Nations Development Program, this reclaimed land is designed to remain above projected sea levels beyond the year 2100, which, like, 2100 seems like a very far away year, but I guess it's only 75 years away. It's really not that far, actually.
Oh, my God, that's true.
We might still be alive.
Yes, you're right there.
And, of course, Tuvalu is at great risk of sea level rise, climate change impacts. Its scientists predict that by 2050, so in just 25 years, that much of Tuvalu could be uninhabitable because of that sea level rise. So this is quite a welcome project, of course. Hopefully that land can remain above any sea level rise because Tuvaluans, of course, don't want to have to leave Tuvalu. They want to be able to stay if possible. Now, speaking at the completion ceremony, Tuvalu's Prime Minister Feleti Teo said the land would provide safe ground for homes, schools and essential infrastructure.
Oh, well, it's a positive story in what's a negative overall story, but good to see that those sorts of initiatives are taking place. And finally, to some royal news, and Fiji's president has met with King Charles.
Yes, Fiji's President Nangama Lalabalavu has met with King Charles at Buckingham Palace in London yesterday, where in a statement put out by Buckingham Palace, the two reaffirmed the friendship between the two nations. No further details have been released about the meeting, but this meeting does come off the back of King Charles recently celebrating Fiji's 55th independence anniversary just a few days ago. And in a statement then, a couple days ago, he said that he does hope to return to Fiji one day in the future. He last visited the country in 1970 during Fiji's first independence celebration. As we know, just last year, he was in Samoa for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. So perhaps another Pacific visit could be on the cards.
And lastly, Jordan, we do have some bonus news out of Samoa this morning with the New Zealand government. They've pledged millions more to help coral reefs affected by a sunken Navy ship.
Yes, yes. This news just coming through from our reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin, who we just heard on the program a little earlier. Of course, about a year ago, the HMNZS Manawanui Navy ship smashed into a reef off the coast of Samoa and sunk in the Safata district, spewing diesel into the surrounding waters, although, of course, the New Zealand government has contested how much of an oil spill there might have been there. Now, Adele Fruin, our reporter in Samoa, has told me that there was a meeting yesterday in the Tafitoala village with the New Zealand High Commissioner, and now the New Zealand government has pledged another $14 million to rehabilitate coral reefs that were damaged when that Navy ship sank. This comes off the back of the New Zealand government already pledging $5.3 million in a compensation payout to the Samoan government.
Oh, that's great news. And in case they're listening, Micronesia could use some help as well.
Sunken ships.
Perhaps from Australia, US, Japan, anyone who might be able to provide some. That would be very, very appreciative, I'm sure. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us for NewsWrap this morning.
Of course.
That was the ABC's Jordan Fennell.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
It is Thursday, October 16. I'm Kyle Evans and you're listening to Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. And if you're just tuning in, it's been a busy show so far, starting with the 50-year anniversary of the Balabo Five, where five Australian journalists were murdered by Indonesian forces while working in East Timor. We also took a broad look at the threat Micronesia's World War II shipwrecks still pose to this day and why they can't easily be cleaned up.
The challenge with working in the Pacific, so Chuuk, Solomons, Marshall Islands, is just the sheer distances involved for getting kind of the vessels you'd need, the people, all the equipment there. So the cost is significantly higher than the rest of the world.
Stay tuned because up next we're going to take a look at the threat that is polio and what PNG is doing to counter it.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. And Papua New Guinea's Department of Health has launched the second round of its nationwide polio immunisation program. PNG recently confirmed its first case of paralysis from polio since the May outbreak, which underscores the urgent need to stop transmission. The campaign will run until the end of the month. And our reporter Jordan Fennell spoke to PNG's Minister for Health, Elias Kapavore, for more.
Our target was to immunise up to 2.3 million children under the age of 10. But the first round as of last 6th of October, which is supposed to be the first round ending, we vaccinated only less than, 1.9 million children. That's but achieving an average of, to date, 83%. We would like our percentage to be at 95%, but we achieved 83%. We wanted to improve that to above 95% in the second round.
What were some of the challenges for why you couldn't reach that 95% in the first round? What were some of the obstacles you came up against?
Obstacles are mainly, Papua New Guinea is generally remote, difficult terrains, Many of our people live in above like 80% of our people are still living in remote areas, and generally that's to do with the geography. Another obstacle we saw was the lack of communication, lack of public awareness. Do the parents who are supposed to bring their children, the children who are supposed to be immunized, so they were not really sure of the dates and the venues that were set.
Yeah, so what will you be doing differently this time around for this second round of immunizations to try and get it up to that 95%?
We have learned a lot of lessons from the first round. That's one. To do with funding, funding must be going a bit earlier than the first round. The issue with funding coming through the system, that usually delays in some of the funding that goes through the system and the clearance of the funds for they actually to be used. That's one that we have now addressed. And more awareness. More awareness means using different modes of awareness, using churches, using community leaders. So long as we can get the message across to everyone through different means and forms, which I believe now is very clear that it's all of community support. People from every sectors coming together to actually support.
And what parts of PNG are you targeting specifically? What areas and cities and townships is this immunization campaign targeting?
We're targeting mainland, Lae first, and then the Highlands provinces. That was the first round. And in NCD, but mostly because of the detection of the virus was also in NCD, National Capital District. So it is NCD, but mostly and Lae and the Highlands provinces. That was the first round. The second round will now cover the entire part of the country, that including the Nguyen Islands region and some parts of the southern region. That's actually generally the entire country that we want to now increase the coverage to above 3 million. At least 3 million children under the age of 10 years.
And is the goal to eradicate polio, to get rid of it completely?
That is the goal at the moment, yes. We did that back in 2000, and I don't think it is impossible to achieve the same goal. If we can achieve 95% in the second round, I'm very positive that we can eradicate poliovirus from Papua New Guinea again. I believe it is not impossible.
Would you have any message for the people of Papua New Guinea, for parents in particular, about the importance of this immunization campaign?
This polio vaccine, so the campaign targets children up to 10 years, and that's generally all the students in elementary schools. They must keep awards on every public notice or every information about polio in their respective communities and make it their commitment. Make it the responsibility to follow those instructions and to make sure that they bring their children to where the health workers are or where the people who are doing polio vaccinations are. That is very, very important. I'm saying this because the first case who actually had paralysis, unfortunately, that was Lae as well. And this particular child was always living in one of the urban areas in Lae, not in somewhere in the remotest part of the country. That was in the main center in Lae, who was not actually vaccinated. And that is a responsibility of the parents to bring their children when the health workers come to the areas.
That was PNG's Minister for Health, Elias Kapavore, speaking to our reporter, Jordan Fennell.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
When's Emily getting a show?
Well, she kind of runs this one.
She does run this
one. I don't mind being in the background, guys. I can just roll my eyes and shake my head at all the things you say. I'm happy with that.
But you know how some places have like a swear jar? We need like an eye roll / head shake jar for Emily's show.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. And measles and rubella is one of the most contagious human diseases known and is still a significant threat in several regions. But according to the World Health Organization, they've announced some good news. 21 Pacific Island countries have been verified as having eliminated measles and rubella. So how was this achieved, and can there be a potential risk of a resurgence? WHO Regional Director Dr. Sayamau Puikala told Lucy Cooper that countries must not be complacent with the achievement of vaccination.
I think this is a moment of celebration. Pacific Island countries are now among the leaders in measles and rubella elimination within the Western Pacific region. They are highlighting that this is achievable. Pacific Island countries inspire our collective pursuit of measles and rubella elimination in our region and globally. But I want to remind the Pacific Island countries not to be complacent with this achievement. Verification is not the end point. The risk of outbreaks remain real if we let our guard down. Very important to maintain the vaccination coverage.
Could you explain precisely what elimination of measles and rubella means?
It basically means, Lucy, that the endemic measles or rubella transmission has been interrupted for at least 36 months, or say 3 years, you know, by compelling evidence across the criteria that's set by the regional verification committee. There has to be a measles and rubella epidemiology. There is a population immunity or vaccination coverage, the quality of epidemiological and laboratory surveillance, sustainability of the national immunization program, and virological genotyping evidence.
How is this data collected to prove that a disease has been eliminated?
WHO country offices and the regional office are working closely with all Pacific Island countries to get the data that is needed for this verification. There is a regional verification committee. There is also a sub-regional verification committee and the sub-regional verification committee from the Pacific Island countries.
How will these countries have to ensure that they maintain that elimination?
The recommendation for Pacific Island countries to sustain the elimination, to ensure that every child receives two doses of MCV on time, identifying and closing immunity gaps, and especially in low immunization coverage area, maintain high immunization coverage, and also important to maintain the high quality surveillance to identify measles, and also to revise or renew the joint plan of action to sustain the elimination in the Pacific.
Seeing the excellent news of the elimination of measles and rubella across all of these Pacific Island countries, what lessons has the WHO learnt from this elimination situation?
The lesson learned, the importance of high immunization coverage, the importance to ensure that every child receives two doses of MCV on time. And if there's an immunity gap, we need to identify and close that immunity gap. And especially in low coverage areas, we need to maintain high quality surveillance system to detect measles cases early. And the best investment that parents can give their children is to give them the two doses of MCV. That's the best investment to immunize your children.
Do you believe there are risks in terms of resurgence?
Yes, the risk of resurgence of measles will definitely happen if we let our guard down, you know, with our immunization coverage. The resurgence will happen in low immunization coverage areas. So the message is that immunization is very critical to protect our children. Parents can sleep well at night. doctors and nurses can do their work and focus on other things rather than looking after this. No child should get sick or die for measles.
Dr. Saia Maupuikala, he was the WHO regional director, and he was speaking with Lucy Cooper. Well, the Gulf of Carpentaria in Australia's north is a global hotspot for marine debris. But nets and other fishing gear dropped off ships is washing up by the ton on remote beaches, causing a serious environmental problem. A federal program that funds the removal of so-called ghost nets is about to expire, raising the prospect of Indigenous rangers being left to deal with the mountains of waste on their own. James Elton reports.
Deep in an Aboriginal protected area on the coast of Arnhem Land, a group of rangers and volunteers from the conservation group Sea Shepherd work to dislodge a large net that's wrapped itself around a dead tree. Hundreds of hermit crabs escape the net and flee towards the ocean.
They don't belong in here. They belong in the mangroves.
Larger nets buried in the sand have to be pulled out by winch using four-wheel drives. This clean-up team has come to this remote section of the Northern Territory coastline to remove tons of fishing gear. It's been pulled in on ocean currents from the Arafura and Timor Seas to the north, which are heavily fished by Indonesia and by illegal and unregulated fishing operations. Sea Shepherd's ocean debris campaigner Graham Lloyd says the nets do enormous damage on their way.
Once they're at sea, they then continue to float through the ocean, making like a wall of death if you think about it, because everything that is caught in those nets then dies. And then they end up, you know, with fish and turtles and dugongs and potentially whales and dolphins all trapped in them.
For the Indigenous people who live in this area, the nets pose a direct threat to important sources of food, as senior Numbulwa Numbarindi ranger Joanne Pomery explains.
Shop very expensive. The best thing is to stick on country food, you know. Go out fishing, stingrays, shark, turtle, dugong, that's all our taka we eat.
The federal government's $15 million ghost net initiative has subsidised ranger groups to do this work over the past 4 years. But the money is about to run out. Graham Lloyd from Sea Shepherd is worried about what will happen if the program isn't renewed.
It's going to be the end of a lot of the resources and the tools that the rangers need. They'll no longer be able to fund themselves to come out on these cleanups.
Clive Nungagalu is another senior ranger and a cultural leader in his community.
We don't worry about money much, but if you get the message, you government people, we need to protect our country and keep us our country really strong. So we want to get support from you guys, you know.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Albanese government told the ABC additional funding has been provided, while longer-term funding is considered, with the money now due to expire in December this year. Last year, the government announced a separate $1.4 million to work with Indonesia and PNG on regional solutions to ghost nets to try to stop them at their source. GhostNet researcher Karen Edivane of Australian National University says Australia could be doing much more to help its neighbours get on top of illegal fishing.
We need in-country presence. If you're serious about working together, we need to have people in-country, in Indonesia, in Timor-Leste, in Papua New Guinea, working side by side with their fisheries counterparts.
Back on the beach in the Gulf, ranger Clive Nungagalu says even though the nets will keep coming, the cleanups are important, making beaches safe for wildlife and for children to play on.
When I see the beach clean, so I don't worry about the kids. Now they can play and enjoy their life in the beach here along the sand. So really, really good for me when I see beach nice and clean, make me proud.
James Elton reporting there.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground having conversations and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Time to take a look back at our main story in Samoa. Former Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa is suing the man who beat her at the last election for defamation over claims she meddled in a murder investigation.
Fiamme made the announcement that she was planning to file this lawsuit way before the election even happened. I believe, if I recall correctly, it was during the time before the election that she made this announcement. And now, finally, now after the election and everything has gone through, now she has officially filed it earlier this week on Monday. So allegedly, the claim centers on remarks delivered by Prime Minister Lauren Malietor during a fast party rally. Now, this was held on July 16, 2025 in Savai at the Fa'asaleleanga number 4 district.
That was Samoa's Adele Fruin there. Please join us at the same time tomorrow. I'm Kyle Evans. Have a great day.